team help you through the entire process from start to finish. Professional Pride Realty, providing you with good information to make good decisions.
Graphic Mailbox means business. Our team of experts focuses on saving you time and money by ensuring you get the right products and services at the right price in a single quick visit. We can pack and ship almost anything to almost anywhere in the world. But shipping is only one way we can help make your...
Okay, are we on the meeting now? Can anybody hear me?
I'm not getting, I can barely hear you on this through the headphones. Oh, there we go. Okay, I can hear you now. Raymond, can you hear me?
Yep, you're fine.
Okay.
You're going to have a little bit of an echo.
Okay.
We're going to have to deal with that for today, though. Okay, I think if you're ready to go, we're going to be on.
Oh.
Here we go. Hold on.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 12th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. I'm going to change things up a little bit. I'm starting off our show today with some personal news to share. This is going to come as a shock to Jeff Johnson, who's sitting across from me here in the booth, the station owner. Yesterday, January 11th, David Bruns, my co-author, he and I launched our fifth novel. The book is called Command and Control, and it is the first book in a new three-book trilogy of interconnected stories. Our novels occupy a genre we call national security thrillers, and you could think of them as Tom Clancy-like novels, but crafted for the modern world. David and I have been writing together since 2014, and if you want to learn a little bit more about our writing, I invite you to visit the website www.davidbruns.com to learn more. Command Control can be found at all major online booksellers, and we have hardback, paperback, audio, and ebook versions for sale through our publisher, Seven River Publishing. If you do buy Command and Control, you won't have to wait too long for the next book in our trilogy. Our sixth novel, Counterstrike, will launch on February 8th. Okay, let's go ahead and get started with our show. I think you're going to like our discussion today. We have a lot to cover. Last year, we discussed the topic of China, and we're going to continue to cover China routinely on National Security This Week throughout the year. And why is that? Well, because China poses the most serious geostrategic challenge to the United States in the world today. China has advanced very quickly in numerous military capabilities, and China's national security decision-making has fundamentally changed over the past decade, with China now routinely projecting power out beyond what was often referred to as the first island chain. Because of the geostrategic significance of China's activities, we're going to continue our study of China throughout this year. So this will be the first of those shows. With us today is someone who can help us to understand China's national security decision-making, their military capabilities, and China's policy strategy match, which you heard us discuss when Professor Stephen Walt and Professor Ron Krebs were on the show a couple weeks ago. We can even get into what to expect from China maybe in the near term. Dr. Raymond Kuo is an expert in international security in East Asia. He's currently a political scientist with the RAND Corporation, one of the top national security think tanks in America. He's published not one, but two books this past year, Following the Leader on Military Alliances and Contests of Initiative on China's Maritime Gray Zone Strategy. Dr. Kuo's other research has appeared in International Security, the Journal of Conflict Resolution, War on the Rocks, The National Interest, The Diplomat, and many others. Dr. Kuo was a tenure-track professor at Fordham University and the University of Albany at SUNY. He previously worked for the United Nations, the National Democratic Institute, and the Democratic Progressive Party in Taiwan. Raymond Kuo holds a doctorate from Princeton University. Dr. Raymond Kuo, thank you for joining us today on National Security This Week.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we do have a lot to cover today. I like to start the show by trying to learn a little bit more about my guest's background. you're a political scientist. You decided to focus much of your study on China. Why China? What is it about the study of China that appeals to you?
Sure. So most importantly, my parents are from Taiwan. My family's from Taiwan. So, you know, we have, you know, so China, how stable it is, how powerful it is, what it wants, is it willing to use force to get it? Those are hugely important questions for my family. And as you mentioned, I'd previously worked for the DPP in Taiwan, which is the current, I guess, governing / ruling party. So everything I say should be taken with a big grain of salt with that in mind. But, you know, a lot of my research focuses on sort of broad trans-historical analysis and asks, how can you deal with the rising powers? How can you coalesce and coordinate opposing coalitions of like-minded countries to ensure that either it rises peacefully, or if it doesn't rise peacefully, that you have the options available to kind of contain it?
Okay. Raymond, can you tell us a little bit about China's advancements in military power projection? How rapidly has the People's Liberation Army evolved in their capability to put sizable military force beyond China's mainland? Let's just start with that discussion, maybe.
Sure. So on the one hand, you can make the benign argument about China that officially China's military spending is generally kept pace with its broader economic growth. You know, it's the second largest economy. Well, it's also the second largest defense spender. Its GDP grows at it used to grow, 10, then 7, then 6% a year. Its military spending has grown slightly less than that. Let's say I'm just kind of making up numbers here, 8, 5, 4%. So you can imagine that as a country grows in power, it legitimately wants to have more and more influence and more and more security for its, say, its economic interests, that kind of thing. However, unofficially, because you can't necessarily trust the numbers, the military spending numbers coming out of China, unofficially, China's definitely grown much more than it's suggested. And it's also in particular focused on capabilities to deny the United States access to East Asia. We're talking things like carrier-killer missiles, advanced anti-air systems. They have the largest missile stockpile in the world. And especially in ranges that the U.S. and also Russia haven't really had, because those two countries were under the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which banned intermediate-range nuclear missiles. China was never part of it. Mm-hmm. And so it has, the ability to strike, say, 300 to 600 kilometers out, right when, say, the U.S. Navy is kind of pulling into East Asia, and China therefore has the ability to kind of drive us out or make a long-range strike before we're really ready. You can think of them as largely defensive systems, but now we're starting to get traditional power projection. China has two carriers, one that I believe it bought from Ukraine, the other it developed indigenously. They also have a fleet-sized carrier in development now. And so we typically think of aircraft carriers as the kind of, I was going to say prima donna, but maybe that is true. You were in the Navy, you can tell me that's an accurate way of calling them. They are the kind of the primary way we think that states project power out beyond their borders. We also have extensive modernization of the People's Liberation Army. That's the PLA. Even though it says army, it really means the entire Chinese military.
Right.
And this especially includes the Air Force, the Navy, and also what they call the strategic rocket forces, those missile stockpiles I mentioned. And lastly, there's some really innovative, gotta hand it to them, they have some really innovative development to handle, say, a Taiwan invasion scenario. Converting civilian ferries so they have roll-on, roll-off capability for military vehicles. So even though a lot of people say, China doesn't have that many amphibious vehicles to launch an invasion of Taiwan, well, they have a lot of civilian shipping. If those ships are hardened so that they can actually carry several military vehicles, that gives the Beijing quite a lot of capacity. So overall, their modernization has advanced quite quickly. They have the second largest budget. The budget, unlike, say, the United States, is focused very much on competing against the United States, whereas the U.S. has a lot of diverse interests. So they very much are a rising peer competitor.
Let me ask you a follow-up question a little bit about that rapid advancement in capability and even capacity. China, they really advanced very, very quickly over the last 20 years in their capabilities in a lot of areas. They're very good at reverse engineering technology that they acquire, oftentimes through espionage. How has that impacted their security, policy in the fact that they've been able to leap ahead with some of their most advanced fighter jets, new construction ideas on submarines, things like that, that are almost peer competitors to what the United States has spent hundreds of billions of dollars to develop. The Chinese steal some of that technology, reverse engineer it, and very quickly turn around and start mass producing those things. What's the impact there?
Right. So, I mean, it's a great point. I tend to think that we don't want to overstate how powerful China is. So, for example, it's hard to tell because, again, their bookkeeping is kind of opaque. but it's been suggested that, you know, up to a third of its military spending is actually focused on domestic spending. So domestic security, whether that be Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong now. Yeah. And so to some extent, it would behoove China to actually release more of this information. They don't do it because it's kind of it would be a stain or a black mark on the CCP's governance to say, like, you need to spend like a really big chunk of money just to control your own internal population. That suggests you're not really that legitimate. But it would also help other countries think that, well, you know, they have the second largest military spending, but it's not as threatening as it seems because they have to focus so much domestically. Also, you know, we think about like the J-31. It looks essentially like a copy of the F-35, which I think is widely assumed that the Chinese were able to hack. I forget the manufacturer, but steal a lot of the plans. At the same time, it's the problem with reverse engineering or stealing things. There's a Mauro and Andrea Gili. They're two twin brothers, political scientists. They have a great piece out there from a few years back about how even though China does steal technology, it doesn't necessarily translate into better capabilities.
Yeah.
That yes, you tend to leapfrog a little bit more. There's a second mover advantage, but because you didn't actually do the development process, you are not as able to understand, like, why did you put all this stuff together?
Right.
Why missed that critical learning process. And so it gives you certain advantages, but it might kind of under the hood provide a bunch of other disadvantages that we just can't see yet.
Yeah. And I would highlight the fact that experience matters in executing operations, and the United States has unfortunately, frankly, a wealth of combat experience over the last two, three decades. China really hasn't been in any major war of any kind for a very long time. So even though they may have strong capacity, their real capabilities to carry out war, because war is really an exercise in confusion and terror, may not be as good as we're anticipating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, during the early part of the later part of the Hu Jintao regime and then now into Xi Jinping, there was this concerted effort at modernization, which I think really worried a lot of people in the American defense community because, like, oh, wow, China seems to be really serious about cutting out the dead weight, streamlining and getting a really professional military training and force acquisition process.
That is true.
I think that feeling has been tempered a little bit just because, you know, as Xi Jinping becomes more of a personalistic dictator,
right,
then it becomes, you know, he's consolidating control. You know, when they execute a whole bunch of generals, were they actually executing like the bad people, like the people who were less effective? Or was it just about putting Xi Jinping's like personal generals in control,
yeah,
which degrades force readiness?
Like Stalin's purge of Tukhachevsky and the other leaders, 1935-36, before Russia, Soviet Union was dropped into the war.
Exactly.
So, let's sort of move into the South China Sea discussion. I wanted to start with sort of a discussion on China's military capabilities. We'll continue that with this next question. When I started training to become an intelligence officer in the U.S. Navy back in early 1991, the first research paper, the analytical research paper that I drafted at Intel School was on the People's Liberation Army Air Force's aerial refueling capabilities, right? That sounds kind of benign. Why is that important? Back then, the PLAAF was just starting to work on that technology, that aerial refueling capability. But I knew even back then that would eventually give them the ability to push fighters and even bombers out to a much greater range to project power beyond China's shores. So you fast forward to today, China now has pretty good aerial refueling capabilities, and they have advanced fighters and bombers. What have they been doing with their long-range air capabilities lately?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest one, this is a little bit outside of the South China Sea, but I think it's relevant, has been vis-a-vis Taiwan.
Yep.
Now, Taiwan, I wouldn't necessarily call that long-range, but they're able to conduct these air operations because they have the cover of longer range air defenses and also power projection. So, you know, in October, we saw about 150 incursions into Taiwan's ADIZ, the Air Defense Identification Zone. Mm-hmm. So this isn't an incursion into Taiwan's territorial waters, but it is an incursion, an unprecedented number of incursions into the zone where you have to say, like, hey, who are you? And if you don't tell us who you are, we might have to resort to some sort of coercive measure, like flying up a plane to go check you out.
Mm-hmm.
And their ability to sortie about 150 planes over the course of a week, or less than a week, actually, is pretty impressive. I mean, maintaining that pace of operations with that many planes, and especially the configuration of planes they had. It wasn't just, say, short-range fighters, but also a combination of electronic warfare planes alongside bombers suggests the ability to conduct an alpha strike, like kind of the weighted first strike in the opening engagement of a war. Plus, in total, China has about, I think, 1,700 aircraft. So it's a pretty large fleet.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing to note is that as big as it is, it's not as advanced as say, the U.S. or even the Russian fleets. Their most prominent fighter jet, kind of fighter bomber, is the J-20, and it's huge. It's absolutely enormous. You put this up against like an F-22, and I think it's like double the size. This thing is gigantic. It technically is a stealthy plane, but really it's not built for stealth. It's built to carry a whole bunch of weapons, get in quickly, unload, and then get out as fast as possible. I mentioned the J-31. It's kind of a copy of the F-35. And it's important to note that, you know, a lot of the PLAAF and the PLANAF, they're about a third of the aircraft are older generation that won't really pose that much of a challenge to the United States.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a lot of them, right? And attrition in war is actually, you know, it can be a useful strategy in this case.
True.
And so, you know, their focus is on a standoff fight, not necessarily having tactical engagements. But then again, the U.S. is also kind of the same boat.
Yeah, so two quick follow-up items. That aerial refueling capability, even though Taiwan's not that far away, what it does give the People's Liberation Army Air Force the ability to do is loiter a lot longer.
Yeah.
and a good strategy on their part, because the Taiwanese Air Force is much smaller.
Right.
If it forces the Taiwanese Air Force to send aircraft up to respond time and time and time again, it's wearing down those aircraft, wearing down the pilots, et cetera. So there's sort of a two-front benefit to China to do that.
Absolutely. And just to kind of jump in on that one, I think the main advantage that, say, the U.S. and its partners has vis-a-vis this sort of capability is that China doesn't have full carrier battle group operations yet.
Right.
Like, they have carriers, right?
Yeah.
But they don't have an entire battle group that surrounds and protects the carriers that can constantly keep these planes up in the air. And so their power projection is limited. Yes, they have aerial refueling, but they're also kind of contained within, say, a whole bunch of ADIZs. Or, you know, as soon as, if you were to try to conduct an aerial refueling operation outside in the Pacific, everyone would know, because you'd have to pass all those planes through everyone else's ADIZs.
Right.
It makes it very hard for them to be able to train and conduct these kind of operations, or to practice these operations.
So
that said, eventually they will be able to do it,
and
do it very, very fluidly.
And so I'm hoping to focus a little bit down into the South China Sea. So Hainan Island becomes a strong base of operations for the Chinese as they push air power down into the South China Sea. We know that China flies regularly down into the South China Sea with these aerial refueling capabilities. Can you tell us a little bit of what China has done in both the Paracel and Spratly Islands? I suspect many of our listeners have maybe heard the names of some of those islands, because they do come up in the news once in a while, but maybe we could get into the specifics. Tell us a little bit about the Chinese bases in the Paracel and Spratly Islands.
Sure. And so, you know, these are, I mean, technically not islands.
Yeah.
there's a very strict legal definition of what constitutes an island under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea,
right.
UNCLOS, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. And so we call these islands, but they're usually just maritime features. Oftentimes they are submerged when the tide comes in. That said, China, and you know, to be fair, all the South China Sea claimants have reclaimed some of these islands to create, you know, taking this sort of shoal and then making it into like an actual proper island that can sustain life. It legally doesn't count as an island under UNCLOS, but it is like you can actually do things from it. And so for China, they've, you know, it's the scale of what China's done that set it apart. It's reclaimed far more territorial land than all the other claimants combined. It's also militarized some of these islands as well. I think the big three are Fiery Cross, Mischief Reef, and Subi Reef. And so you have military-style airstrips on each of these islands, advanced anti-air area denial systems, so air defenses. And also, especially I think on Fiery Cross, there are underground stockpiles. So just, you know, kind of weapons caches for a longer fight. And so these islands allow China to project power into the South China Sea and essentially give their... Oh, I should have mentioned this, sorry. Going back to their capabilities, it's not just that China has impressive military capabilities, which they do, but it's also that they have impressive sub-conventional military capabilities. This would be the Chinese Coast Guard, the People's Armed Forces Maritime Militia. These are nominally civilian organizations that, you know, it's, especially with the Maritime Militia, you're talking an unknown number of ships, maybe of several hundred, maybe close to 1,000, which are essentially fishing trawlers. Very lightly armed if they're armed at all. But what they often do is if, say, they feel like they see a Philippine fishing trawler is encroaching upon what they consider to be Chinese territory, the maritime militia will just surround that boat and drive them away, either by ramming or sometimes using water cannons, that kind of thing. And so I think the important thing to understand is that the island building in the South China Sea is in coordination with the sub-conventional civilian capabilities that they have. That the islands and their ability to project power give these civilian forces sort of top cover. You can go and harass a Philippine trawler because you know the Philippine Air Force doesn't want to come over and settle the issue because they'll get shot down by the air defenses on Fiery Cross or Mischief Reef.
Yeah.
So it's very much part of an integrated strategy that you'll have island reclamation plus a civilian ability to coercively push other claimants out of the area.
So that you covered that in your book, Contests of Initiative, right? Did we lose you?
Oh, sorry, I couldn't hear you. I think we were on mute.
Oh, so Contests of Initiative, the book you wrote on China's maritime gray zone, was that covered that in detail, right?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So let's keep pushing forward. I do want to take a quick identification break here, if I could. We have, for our audience, so you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Raymond Kuo, and we're discussing China, the South China Sea, and a little bit about ASEAN as part of our focus on China throughout 2022. Raymond, why are the Spratly Islands so valuable to China?
Sure. I mean, on their own, they're just rocks. In fact, like they're less than rocks, right? Like they're rocks that sometimes come above the water and sometimes are under the water. I think there are three reasons. First is that, one, if you're able to convert these rocks into proper islands and then use those islands to project power, well, that helps to secure your supplies. A lot of trade to China and from China passes through the South China Sea. And so if China doesn't control these waterways, then who does? Well, that's the U.S. Navy. And if you're a rising power, well, you kind of want to make sure that, you know, the control of your own trade routes lies in your own hands. So that's one reason. Secondly, if you can get these rocks recognized as proper islands, then it confers upon what's called an exclusive economic. And also you say that you can, you get everyone else to recognize that these islands are yours. Then you get what's called an exclusive economic zone. Mm-hmm. You know, you get exclusive exploitation and exploration rights of whatever resources happen to extend around those islands. And so we think that there's approximately like about 5% of, or equivalent to 5% of oil and natural gas reserves are kind of in the South China Sea. And so if you're able to get the exclusive economic zone, then you can exploit and tap into that kind of underwater riches. I think the bigger issue, the one that really drives this, is nationalism.
Ah.
That, the core interests, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Tibet. Those are the really ones that, like, if other people interfere, China has made it pretty clear that they will resort to military force. The South China Sea is increasingly one of those areas as well, that China has said, we have this nine dash line from this map we found in like 1947. Well, actually, I think the Taiwanese found it, but whatever. We're going to claim it as ours as well. Though essentially, the entire South China Sea, that's ours. And this is a key critical step in getting the rest of the world to respect us and in our national rejuvenation. And so it's that combination of secure supplies, natural resources, and nationalism, which, and especially the latter one, last one, which really drives why China is so interested in this area.
Raymond, let me ask you a question. The U.S. Senate has failed to ratify the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. They won't vote on it. They've been refusing to go along, despite the fact that the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, and even the Merchant Marine, the Maritime Administration, have advocated on behalf of signing on to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Do we lose something in the diplomatic arena by not being a signatory to UNCLOS, with regards to engaging China on this issue of the Spratly Islands?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's even worse is that in 1994, UNCLOS was renegotiated to explicitly carve out exceptions for the United States so that it could, at the time, we were one of the few places that could really exploit deep sea resources. I think that's less so now. But, in 1994, the signatories carved out an exception for the United States, and we still didn't sign it, even after they'd carved out these exceptions. So it's like, well, what do you want us to do? But in terms of a vis-a-vis competition with China, I think it absolutely has effect in at least two ways. One, because we're not a signatory, we can't therefore work with other signatories to challenge China's claims through UNCLOS mechanisms. So in 2013, the Philippines lodged a suit against China saying, you're claiming all this stuff here. You state that there's this nine dash line of these quote unquote historic rights. We're going to call shenanigans on this and say it's not real. UNCLOS, what do you say? And the U.S. supported this suit, but it couldn't really do anything because it wasn't part of UNCLOS.
All
You're not
right.
part of it. You can't tell UNCLOS to do anything. Secondly, I think it also restricts our ability to have a settlement within, say, the South China Sea. Political settlement. Say, look, we want all of you to decide, follow UNCLOS, and recognize that when it says these are or are not islands, you all abide by that. And they can turn around and say, like, well, what do you care? You're not part of this. You're not a member here. So don't butt your head, don't butt your nose into where it's not needed. It's a strong and easy retort, and it's kind of unfortunate that the US can't, it loses a lot of sort of political capital, I guess, to really be able to have an influence because it's not part of it.
Dr. Kuo, maybe we could talk a little bit. You just mentioned the Philippines, a couple of examples there. Maybe you could give us sort of a once over the region. What are the other countries that are around in the South China Sea that are claimants to all or part of the Spratly Islands, as an example?
Sure thing. So China has the most expansive claim. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. Taiwan also does too. Their claims are essentially synonymous. Weirdly enough, despite how much Taiwan and China kind of butt heads on this, on other issues, they are really aligned on South China Sea claims because they keep pointing back to this nine dash line 1947 map. The Philippines have a couple claims to the in the Spratly Islands. Vietnam does so as well. Malaysia and also Brunei. But the thing about all the other ones barring China is that these are they have built outposts. These are much smaller outposts, much less technologically advanced. And I think there is a worry within the United States that if somehow the U.S. were just to solve this China issue, then all these other claimants would come back, and you'd be right back into the situation you're in, where China says, "Look, everybody else is building islands. Why shouldn't I build islands too?" And you're kind of give yourself 10, 15 years, you're right back into the mix again. which I think underscores the need for the United States to sign on to UNCLOS if it really wants to solve this issue. That there is a legitimate international regime out there about how we sort out these issues. They are very much aligned with the United States' interests because we had a very strong hand in negotiating it. And yet we didn't sign. And so everyone else, especially in sort of the South China Sea, kind of takes it as, well, then maybe there's some wiggle room for us to push out these claims vis-a-vis all of our other counterparts. And it just kind of leaves a sort of policy mess.
So if we expand out a little bit more to the region, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN? What role are they playing in helping to solve this diplomatic conundrum in the South China Sea?
So they're trying. I want to give them credit where credit's due. They are trying to coalesce Southeast Asian to taking a united position vis-a-vis territorial claims in the South China Sea. The problem is a couplefold. One is that ASEAN is a consensus decision-making body. So essentially that means everyone has to agree, but that also means any single state has an ability to veto whatever happens.
Yeah.
And so during the Philippine, when they were bringing up the case on the arbitral tribunal, I believe China had reached out to Cambodia, which was the ASEAN chair at the time, and essentially quashed any sort of ASEAN statement on the Philippine suit, just because, well, it's the chair and also everyone has a veto. So it's really easy to pick off a particular country and get them to kind of stymie everything else. In addition, because it's a consensus-based organization, so ASEAN's tried to create a maritime code of conduct amongst its own members, and then coalesce that to give enough political weight to get China to sign on as well. That hasn't really gone anywhere. Initially, they wanted to be binding, but then they made it non-binding. Originally, they wanted to have some kind of enforcement mechanism. It all got watered down because China was able to talk to two or three of its closer trading partners within ASEAN and say, we really don't like that. Here are the consequences if you follow through with this. Here is also like some carrots that you may like in order to get you not to kind of to block some of this process. And so ASEAN, unfortunately, has been a kind of a relatively minor player in this because it can't figure out collectively what it wants to actually do. Speaking personally here, John, you and I participated in a South China Sea simulation at the EU late last year. And a lot of the dynamics that came out of that simulation with master students, I think really reflected what was going on, that countries like Indonesia or Cambodia, especially Cambodia, which doesn't really have any territorial claims or like a navy really, just doesn't care about this kind of thing, right? Yeah. They're like, I don't really care about the South China Sea. It's really not that important to me. And so the Chinese can come in and kind of pick off some of these countries and leverage their bilateral weight to stymie the entire multilateral organization.
So what I hear you saying is that, we talk a lot on this show about the tools of national power, diplomacy, information, military, and economic power. And every country has those tools. They can use those tools as they see fit to pursue their national security objectives. In the case of the South China Sea, ASEAN has pretty much been rendered moot because China uses their economic tools of power to put enough political pressure on some of the countries in the ASEAN group to block any action to prevent them from doing whatever they want to do in the South China Sea.
Yep, absolutely. And also I would add to that, they take advantage of the institutional constraints within ASEAN because it's so consensus oriented. And because there is a sort of veneer, I don't mean to be critical of this, but there it feels like there's always a veneer of sort of regional unity that's upheld and sacrifices certain states or bilateral interests in the name of that sort of regional unity, even though this is a fairly thin organization that just hasn't been able to coalesce on some of these bigger security issues.
Does ASEAN need to adapt to the challenges of the modern day world? I mean, would they be better off sort of moving in the direction of a NATO alliance? Or, I mean, I know there's a tremendous historical set of circumstances that impact that. But China, having demonstrated what they've done internally and sort of the coercive nature of a lot of their exercise of the tools of national power externally, I mean, are the ASEAN nations starting to kind of wake up to the fact that they might be under Beijing's control before they know it?
I mean, some of them are, some of them aren't. I'd shift the framing slightly.
Okay.
That, you know, for countries like, not to pick on Cambodia, but it's just Cambodia, or Indonesia even, they have at best adopted sort of a hedging strategy. Okay. That, and I think in part because their interest is not necessarily security related. Their interest is economically related. Mm-hmm. So long as there's free access to the South China Sea and goods and services can pass through, or I guess goods, not services, but goods can pass through, then it's really not that big of a deal for either of these countries, you know, who's in control. Whereas for a country like Vietnam, they're very much concerned, given their long coastline, like they're very much concerned about what who actually controls it, what rules they follow, and who they need, what they need to comply with. And so, you know, should ASEAN adapt? I would think so. Can ASEAN adapt? I tend not to think so. And so I think we're starting to see that Vietnam, even the Philippines, with Duterte still in office, he was kind of anti-US for a while, but I think the relationship with China hasn't panned out as well as he had hoped. And so even he is kind of flipping back towards the United States. You're starting to see a splintering of ASEAN, which sort of, you know, ASEAN as a group has tried to tamp down some of these centrifugal forces, but I'm not sure how long they can continue to do so. They either need to make a decision as a group, or you're just going to see a hollowing out of the organization.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Raymond Kuo, and we're discussing China, the South China Sea, and ASEAN as part of our focus on China throughout 2022. Okay, Raymond, let's discuss the strategic consequences of China having built military bases in the South China Sea. How do those bases and China's continuous presence, how do they impact the region?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are kind of generally two schools of thought. The first is that, great, you've put a whole bunch of targets, relatively hardened, relatively not, in a stationary location. Thank you for making so clear where your assets are. Let's bomb them. And I think this is maybe the U.S. Navy or the Air Force tends to say this, that it's not a big deal because they're just right there and we can destroy them at will. Leaving aside the operational difficulty or not of taking out these bases, I think the bigger question is political. And this is tends to be where I fall on the second school of thought, that yes, you may be able to destroy these really easily, but at the same time, are you going to do that?
Right.
Wouldn't that be an escalation to war? And if so, if you're not willing to escalate to war, doesn't that mean these bases still serve a purpose? And this is kind of why I was talking about the subconventional capabilities with the Chinese Coast Guard and maritime militia, that if your only recourse is to go to war, then that gives China lots and lots of space at the sub-war level to do a lot of things that they want. So they can use these bases as, you know, refueling points, as places to for ISR, intelligence, surveillance, or reconnaissance, yeah. to get an understanding of what's going on in the area, to show the flag. You know, the Chinese don't necessarily want control of the South China Sea. I mean, they do, but really what they want is compliance. Yeah. That other states follow their rules. And so these bases, in combination with those subconventional capabilities, gives them the ability to show the flag, to intimidate, to make sure that everyone recognizes that we are here and you have to follow our rules. And those rules include letting us have a lot of leeway to explore and exploit whatever natural resources happen to be in the area.
Yeah, I guess when you have a, you know, a population of, what is it, 1.3 billion people and a continuously growing economy, you need to have access to natural resources. And if you can get them relatively close to home, that's a lot easier than going all around the world to try and acquire them.
I mean, to some extent. But, you know, the one advantage about the U.S. international system, the U.S.-led international system, is that it's a free trade system. Mm-hmm. China doesn't need to do this, right? It's doing this because it's worried about the security of its supply lines. But exploiting deep sea resources, well, we don't do it for a reason, because it's expensive and it's dangerous. It's just much easier to haul the oil from the Middle East, where you scratch the surface and the geyser comes out. And so I think part of the issue here is that it doesn't necessarily make economic sense. And this is why I tend to think that nationalism really drives a lot of these issues. That it's about secure control of your sea lanes, and being able to kind of say that we are the top dog in this particular region, and we are creating the assets and the installations that allow us to enforce that sort of compliance.
So we've talked so far in the show about the fact that China is really a rapidly rising military power. They're exercising a heck of a lot more influence diplomatically around the world than they have traditionally, and economically they're a powerhouse. So having these bases down in the South China Sea, what's the psychological impact on the political leadership in the other countries around the South China Sea? I mean, are they so intimidated by China that there really isn't anything they're willing to do at this point to sort of push China back? We've talked about the fact that ASEAN has almost been neutered. Are individual countries able to do anything? Are they willing to do anything?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's, you know, what's been surprising to me is that there's a narrative out there about China using its economic weight and ties to essentially buy off states to come to its side. And I haven't seen that actually happen, in part because, you know, trade, economics, they tend to be win-win sort of situations, whereas security ones tend to be win-loss. And so when a security issue confronts an economic one, states tend to choose the security over the economy. And that's what we're seeing here. China has done a remarkable job of losing friends and making enemies through its island building campaign.
That's true. I mean,
you know, Vietnam, of all countries, is developing closer military ties with the United States and Japan. I mean, we fought a war with them like 50
right.
years ago.
Right.
And now they're here like saying, like, we want to actually coordinate with you. And the U.S. is like, yeah, we really want to coordinate with you too. The Philippines, even though Duterte, as I mentioned, was really trying to tack towards China, has come essentially, well, I wouldn't say all the way back into the fold, but the Philippine government is definitely making moves to come back and tighten up those security ties. So if coercion, whether through economic or military means, and compliance was China's goal, then it's clearly backfired for the most security-threatened or security-oriented states in the region. This is a good tailwind for the United States. I think this actually presents a really important opportunity, and the Biden administration is starting to deepen those ties. It's certainly doing it within Northeast Asia, with Korea, Japan, Taiwan, less so with Southeast Asia, in part because Southeast Asia is just politically more fragmented. Hmm.
So I mentioned earlier that we had Professor Stephen Walt from the Kennedy School out at Harvard and Professor Ron Krebs from the University of Minnesota on a couple weeks ago talking about this concept of a grand strategy.
Right.
As part of this grand strategy discussion today for you and me, what options are on the table for the United States in responding to Chinese moves in the South China Sea specifically? Maybe I'll put it bluntly, if you were sitting on the National Security Council staff right now and China was your responsibility, what options would you put on the table for President Biden and the national security team to consider right now based on the current situation?
Sure. So I think
this is your interview question to join the National Security Council.
There we go. can we clip this and I'll send it over to them?
Okay, all right.
So I think they're doing a lot of things right. As I said, you tend to see more of this in Northeast Asia than Southeast Asia, but it's still there. That it's working with allies and partners to figure out what is the joint response to these moves. I think in the Contest of Initiative book, I wrote that I found that one of the major issues, what determines whether or not China conducts a gray zone operation or conducts a gray zone strategy against you, is what the level of political cohesion or fragmentation among states. And so the more politically cohesive you are, that, like, say, if ASEAN can get together and say, this is what we want, or if you can just create a smaller grouping of, let's say, Malaysia, Philippines, and Vietnam, along with the United States, the more cohesive you are, the less China is able to pursue these gray zone strategies, because it doesn't want to piss off a whole bunch of countries at the same time. It also doesn't want the sort of legitimacy that comes with multilateral pushes back to say that, you know, on the one hand, China can say right now, well, look, The Philippines may be upset, but it's just the Philippines. They're their own individual psychoses and neuroses. The Vietnamese, they may be upset. It's just them. The U.S., it's just them. But if you get all three countries together to say, hey, we are really not okay with this. This is the common principles that you should be following. And those ideally would be linked to UNCLOS. Then it's the Chinese lose a lot of the narrative legitimacy in their claims. And so I think the U.S. is doing a good job in setting that up. I think two things would help out. One is greater economic engagement with the region. I know TPP is kind of a dead letter, but doing TPP would be really good.
Yeah.
I mean, when the U.S. withdrew from that, the Singaporean prime minister said, look, if you, this is a test of your credibility. If you're not going to be able to do economic engagement, why should we trust you that you're going to do security engagement?
Yeah.
If the easy lift of econ is just something you can't even handle, then we are sure that you can't do the heavy lift of military and security.
Yeah, I saw TPP pulling out of TPP as a gift to China. I mean, it was handing over influence in the economic world for the entire Pacific region basin.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think there's some discussions right now about whether or not the United States wants to join up. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that you sacrifice a lot of negotiating leverage, that you had the opportunity, you negotiated before the organization was formed, and you pulled out. And now you are knocking on the door, asking me to let in, and you've just handed over a whole bunch of leverage to the TPP members, which understandably, they're going to leverage as much as possible to make sure that you are committed and are going to stay in.
Yeah, and we should highlight very quickly, TPP did go forward, as you mentioned, not with China in it, but China invited all of the TPP members to join their regional comprehensive trade partnership.
Exactly.
And they all accepted.
I mean, I'm less concerned about that because Chinese sort of trade organizations tend to be fairly thin as well. These are not like what we might consider high quality organizations setting a whole bunch of standards and rules. But the fact that you kind of cede that space to China to allow them to be setting those rules and those standards is not a good thing. And with Asia being the sort of engine of global growth, we really have to be engaging with Asia on its own terms.
Yeah.
And economics development, that is their principal interest and concern.
So let me ask you this. We've talked about all these issues today with regard to the South China Sea. Is conflict brewing over Chinese control of the Spratly Islands? I mean, should we be worried that the Spratlys are a likely flashpoint for open conflict in the region? Is that more likely than, say, a Taiwan scenario, or is Taiwan more likely?
I still think Taiwan is more likely in the sense that Taiwan is very much declared core interest, whereas the South China Sea is kind of quasi there. Xi Jinping has been making more claims to vis-a-vis Taiwan than he has vis-a-vis the South China Sea.
I haven't heard much discussion about South China Sea in the last couple of months. It's been a heavy focus on Taiwan.
Exactly. And this isn't to say that some accident, two ships collide or environmental degradation of some kind, that couldn't generate this kind of a flashpoint. But mm-hmm. In kind of ranking the different priorities, I'd put it definitely below Taiwan. I was wondering, maybe it's below Korea to some extent. David Kang, I was in a discussion with him a few months back, and I believe he said that Korea is more of a flashpoint than Taiwan. I still need to think more about that. But yeah, I tend to think that it's not going to be it's not as much of a flashpoint. But that said, though, China is doing a fairly good job of picking off countries so that it doesn't become a bigger issue. And the status quo benefits China, right?
Right.
Nobody is resisting, then it has a better ability to keep projecting its own power forward. The U.S. can do a better job of listening to regional concerns. I mentioned economics and getting together, and it has to decide whether or not this is actually worth the fight. And if it is worth the fight, then it has to take some of its, take the diplomatic leadership to bring all these countries together into a more cohesive whole on this issue.
So what I think I'm hearing you saying is that the United States is far better off with friends in a dark alley at night than without.
Absolutely.
and that we're better off being politically or diplomatically engaged around the world, especially in crisis points where we have national security interests, than to not be engaged with partners and allies and friends.
Absolutely.
Okay, Dr. Kuo, what else should our listeners know about the South China Sea? What haven't we covered today that that they should know about the region?
Sure, yeah. So one thing that often happens when I'm like giving discussions about Asia is that I often have like the Oriental theme playing in my head. You know, like the kind of like, yeah, it's not a good theme.
I understand.
And I think the issue is that oftentimes in these foreign policy discussions in the United States, we tend to center the United States and China for understandable reasons, right? Like, you're in the United States, you're working for the U.S. or for its interests, you're going to be centering the United States. The primary threat is China. That's who you're going to be focusing on. But Asia is far more diverse than just China. And I think it's really important for the United States, especially, to be listening to third parties. They are persuadable. They are sitting on the fence. And when we listen to them, we're able to actually make great inroads. I think, again, Northeast Asia is a great example of this. Japan and Korea, their presidents and the prime minister, they were their first two summit visits to the White House under the Biden administration. And, you know, the joint statements that were released from those summit meetings, for the Japan case, they mentioned Taiwan for the first time in 52 years.
Right.
with Korea. Yeah. For Korea, I don't know if they'd ever mentioned it before, but they mentioned it then.
Yeah.
And so, you know, especially in the Korea case, you're like, I'm not entirely certain that I see that engagement in Taiwan is in South Korea's interests or directly related. But then again, you could definitely make a case that if China were to take over Taiwan, for example, you'd have much less secure access to goods and trade and commodities that goes up through, you know, the sort of east coast of China. And the ability of the Biden administration to take that sort of nugget and say, no, Korea, this is actually in your interests, and to get them to make a public statement about that and sort of bring the Northeast Asian partners together, that's a sign of what engagement by the United States can do. And so you have to listen to what the people in the region are talking about, what their interests are, and then try to meet them halfway. And so I think that's also kind of underlines the idea that joining TPP or not pulling out of TPP, even better, is very much within the U.S. interests if we want to have a more secure and stable Asia.
Raymond, let's bring it back to this discussion on Taiwan, because Taiwan clearly is a major strategic issue. You recently penned an article back in early December in War on the Rocks called The Counterintuitive Sensibility of Taiwan's New Defense Strategy. As you said, China sort of listed Taiwan as a core interest. Can you tell us a little bit about that article? I mean, what was it that you were trying, the case that you were trying to make?
Sure. So one of the major debates right now happening within the U.S. defense community is that, you know, we still officially have a policy of strategic ambiguity, meaning that it's unclear whether or not the U.S. will actually defend Taiwan if there's, and under what conditions. but it's increasingly clear that the U.S. will line up. I tend to be, this speaking personally, you know, I'm somewhat skeptical that China thinks, oh, well, the U.S. hasn't officially declared. So we can kind of bank on that to say that, oh, they might not show up. I think China assumes that we're going to show up, and therefore, you know, that kind of drives a lot of this dynamic. But within the defense community, the question is, okay, if we're going to show up, is Taiwan adopting the force posture that's necessary to last out and wait it out until we can arrive and kind of bail them out? And so that would mean things like more attritional warfare, anti-tank weapons, anti-ship missiles, guerrilla fighting, optimizing the population for a long-term guerrilla fight. Which, you know, and I think the point I was making in the article was that, look, I understand why that may be more effective, but at the same time, it all depends on the United States coming, riding to the rescue. And if you don't have that, if you don't give Taiwan the guarantee, then it makes a lot of sense for them not to follow that policy. They want to have these big, flashy systems, because if an F-35, but no, they're not getting F-35. But like if an F-16 late model F-16 gets shot down, then they can say, "Well, look, the U.S. one of your premier weapon systems got shot down. Are you going to let that stand?" Well, then you definitely have to come to the rescue. And so for Taiwan, the idea is that first and foremost, we have to have the United States here. Everything else is secondary to that. If our force posture is less effective but brings the United States in, let's do that as opposed to the alternative. And so again, this I think underscores like you have to understand where Asian states are coming from.
You mentioned sort of Taiwan, you know, they have a responsibility, the government does, to prepare their people to defend the island, right, from a mainland invasion. And I would just suggest that a model that they could look at right now, that's happening right now, is in Ukraine. Ukraine passed a law that sort of created all these civilian or citizen militia units, armed them, trained them, prepared them to defend in depth against a potential Russian invasion. So we see that on the news right now today. I think a Russian invasion will probably succeed, but it's going to be a lot more costly for the Russians than they are maybe anticipating. And that same kind of defense in depth in Taiwan with these capabilities you just mentioned, anti-ship cruise missiles, anti-tank weapons, guerrilla fighting, all that kind of stuff, that greatly complicates the challenges for a Chinese invasion with the People's Liberation Army.
Absolutely.
So we're coming to the end of our show today. Dr. Raymond Kuo, thank you for taking time from your busy schedule working at RAND to join us. Can you tell us a little bit more about the two books you launched this year? Rename, give us the titles again and where people can buy them.
Sure. So a lot of the discussion today has been based on my book, Contest Initiative. It focuses on how how the United States and its partners can respond to this maritime gray zone strategy, China's maritime gray zone strategy in the East and South China Seas. The second book is called Following the Leader. This is more of a transhistorical work looking at why do alliances, like how do states develop their alliance strategy? And what do alliances do for the international order? How do they stabilize the international system and what benefits do they provide? Both of these are available for purchase through Amazon, where all of our stuff is now, evidently. Or if you're interested, you can also find them through my website, which is rkuo.weebly, weebly.com.
Okay. Raymond Kuo. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. And as you may have heard me say at the beginning of the show, my latest novel, Command and Control, co-authored with David Bruns, launched yesterday across all the major booksellers. And if you buy Command and Control, please leave an online review. Every review helps, believe me. Have a great finish to your week. Take care, everyone.